You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
Shortly before Christmas, Sam Bankman-Fried, the disgraced founder of FTX and Alameda Research, was arrested by authorities in the Bahamas. After spending a few days in the notorious Fox Hill prison there, he was extradited to the United States and promptly bailed on a $250 million bond. He's now at his parents' house in California, awaiting trial. The saga of FTX and Alameda drags on. Shortly before SBF's arrest, I sat down with Ram Ahluwalia, an expert on both digital assets and the world of traditional finance, to discuss the situation as it was then and try to understand how it ever managed to get so far. Ram had recently published some intriguing threads on Twitter outlining his unique perspective on what happened, and I wanted him to elaborate on them. There have been a fair few developments since we had our conversation, but the vast majority of what we discussed is still relevant. Ram argues that the seeds of this crisis were sown further back than many believe, and that SBF and some of his close colleagues perpetrated a fraud bigger even than that of Bernie Madoff. He also explains some of the ins and outs of high finance, helping shed light on some of the more complex aspects of what FTX and Alameda were involved in. This was a fascinating discussion to have, and Ram's expertise on the matter is second to none. He's well worth following on Twitter, and I'll leave links to his page and other useful resources about him in the description of this episode. Enjoy the show. Hello, everyone. We're very lucky today to be joined by a special guest, Ram Ahluwalia. Ram has an extraordinary CV, really. He's worked in finance for over 20 years. He held senior positions at the likes of Merrill Lynch and Bank of America, and then went on to be head of crypto and digital assets at CrossRiver, and is now the co-founder and CEO of Lumida Wealth, and that's a private investment company that specializes in digital assets. Ram, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Guy. Happy to be here.
It's great to have you. And Ram, the reason I wanted to talk to you today was because, obviously, this CV of yours, you have perhaps better insight than anyone else into I guess, the kind of mysteries of high finance, you know, the inner workings of the financial system. And of course, because you specialize in digital assets, how they sort of interlink with the world of crypto. So inspiration to do this came from a brilliant tweet thread that you put out a few days ago talking about the collapse of FTX and Alameda. And I'm just going to, if you don't mind, Ram, I'm just going to read that first bit out so as to give people a kind of hypothesis. So it starts off, how do we explain FTX's $10 billion in losses? Where did the $2 billion in venture funds go? My working hypothesis is that FTX was a fraud even prior to recent events and as far back as 2021. SBF will go down in history as a fraud larger than Bernie Madoff. Wow. So what we'll do, Ram, is you know, we'll go through some of the things you talk about in that thread. But before we do that, can you just give us where you've been working the last few years and kind of your experience with crypto in particular?
Absolutely. And first, thank you for the kind introduction. I wish my wife is here to hear that. like as you mentioned, my background has been high finance, 20 years, two buckets, banking and capital markets, within capital markets, asset management. Around the 2011 era, I was actually active in statistical arbitrage and investing in high frequency trading strategies. Prior to Lumina, which I'll come back to in a second, I was the executive responsible for building the crypto business at Cross River. Cross River is a B2B2C digital infrastructure bank. We raised money from Andreessen Horowitz as recently as this April around the crypto strategy, as well as other investors, including Rivet, which you may know as well. It's a pre-IPO company. It's a world-class business, highly profitable FDIC bank, and powers crypto companies and other fintechs. So some of our customers include Coinbase. If you wire or send money into Coinbase, through that pop-up screen, they'll say Cross River Bank. So again, we're behind the scenes. We help move money. We help fintechs and crypto companies issue loans and so on and so forth. I've been crypto native for quite a while, since the 2017 era. My wife's been in crypto. My sister's in crypto. My whole family's in crypto. And so there's a tremendous opportunity after Cross River acquired my prior startup, PureIQ, to build a crypto business from scratch. I presently lead Lumida. We're a digital wealth advisory firm. And I recognized, along with my co-founders, that there is an incredible opportunity really to create insight around crypto and apply a traditional finance perspective and approach. I'm the CFA charter holder. My co-founders from Cambridge Associates, he's also a CFA charter holder. And we have another partner from Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, etc. We believe in the promise and potential of crypto, but we think there's an opportunity to deliver insight, deliver service, and deliver access to opportunities to invest in crypto responsibly.
And I guess, Ram, that makes you part of this vanguard of TradFi people who have discovered crypto in the last few years, and really, I guess, helped the crypto market mature an awful lot in that time. I mean, obviously, crypto's only been around for, you know, since 2008. So there's got a lot of development to do. But it really seems in the past few years that the market has matured enormously. And that seems to be because, you know, people like yourself in the TradFi space have seen the potential of it and have started to explore, started to develop new products, new services. And this, in a way, I think, kind of leads into what happened with FTX and Alameda.
Absolutely. No, it's well said. Look, crypto is an alternative capital market, offers new payment rails. These are services banks and Wall Street's done for a long time. So it's attracting a lot of people from traditional finance to see an opportunity for crypto to improve the world we live in.
Before we dig into your hypothesis, Ram, and sure, kind of flesh out the details of it more, I think it would help if for people watching or listening, just to kind of go through a very simplified overview of what happened with FTX and Alameda. And maybe as we go through, you could maybe pick up on some of the
maybe, you know, any of the errors there, and also maybe explain some of the terms, because again, I think a lot of people have felt that there's a, you know, this thing gets more and more complicated with each passing day. So if you're all right to contribute as you know as we go along.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'll summarize at a high level, and there are many layers to this. So I'll start at the simplest level. So FTX International, or FTX Global, is an exchange registered in the Bahamas. How do they make money? Well, they enable their clients to buy and sell crypto, and then they charge transaction fees. FTX has a sister company that's also controlled by Sam Bankman-Fried called Alameda. And Alameda and FTX are inextricably linked. They're attached to the hip. The reason for that is because an exchange needs a market maker, right? So if I have an exchange and you have a deposit, I got to make sure that's one for one backed at the exchange. So let's say, guy, you want to buy a token. In order to enable you to buy that token, without a market maker, you need someone else on the exchange that wants to sell a token at the exact same time, the exact same amount, and the exact same price. That doesn't happen. And so there's a need for liquidity. This is what liquidity is all about. And that liquidity is provided through a market maker. So what is a market maker? A market maker stands ready to offer a security or token or buy a security or token, right? They provide a quote that's called a bid and an ask. A bid is a willingness to pay. The ask is a willingness to sell at a certain price. So that's just kind of definition of players and terms. My hypothesis at a high level is that FTX had a bad market making relationship with Alameda. They faced increasing competition from better players like Jump and Wintermute. That market making operation was negative. They were losing money. Alameda had to resort to more aggressive forms of risk taking to attempt to make money. FTX at some point crossed the line by tapping customer funds to avoid an insolvency situation with Alameda. So that's my high level story of what went wrong.
Absolutely. So I think a good starting point would be, I mean, just to clarify one thing in particular, this idea that FTX and Alameda were, you know, sister companies is a term I've heard used a lot. I mean, what are the legalities of that? I mean, having an exchange and a trading company sitting side by side, is that strictly allowed, or is that something that's completely illegal, or is it kind of in the middle?
In the United States, it's strictly illegal. And that's one of the reasons why this fraud took place in the Bahamas. So in the United States, you have this concept of the segregation of duties and functions. Let me give you an example of what I mean. So you can have a concept of a broker, you have a concept of an exchange, you have a concept of a custodian. Let me walk you through those briefly. I think we all know what a broker is. You can buy and sell stock over the phone or online. That's your broker. The broker can go to an exchange to actually execute that transaction. That exchange could be the New York Stock Exchange, could be NASDAQ, actually could be dozens of other exchanges as well. After you buy that security is custodied at a different kind of institution altogether. And that institution could be, say, State Street or Pershing, for instance. Those are the two leading custodians. One thing to point in mind, though, you'll never find New York Stock Exchange brokering a security or custodying a security. These are all distinct functions, and it's illegal to perform any more of those functions. And part of that is because of things like the Madoff scandal, in addition to other laws that predate that. So in the case of Bernie Madoff, he had his own accounting firm. He was his own broker, and he was custodying all the assets. So there was no checks and balances, and there are no controls. And that is why FTX US allegedly is solvent, and probably their customers will receive their funds unless it's clawed up in this bankruptcy proceeding, and why FTX International Bahamas had these issues.
And I think a useful kind of analogy, going back to Bernie Madoff and the fact that he was, you know, he was fulfilling all these roles. An analogy that you've touched on in the thread is this idea of a casino, of gamblers at a casino. And FTX, well, in this case, Alameda and is the, you know, and FTX are the house. Then you have retail traders, you know, playing at the tables. But Alameda is also playing at the tables. And it's because it's so closely linked to FTX, it's also able to see what everyone else is betting. So it's got this huge, huge advantage, supposedly.
That's right. Yeah. Let me walk through that house metaphor. It's a great analogy here. So Bernie Madoff and SBF were both advertising. And you can see this in the pitch book from SBF, which is floating online. They were advertising the idea of high, consistent, risk-adjusted returns. That's part of the Alameda pitch book, which Suzu criticized. He has some slides out there on Twitter, right? And high-frequency trading is actually a very high profitable strategy and makes consistent money up until it doesn't. And in that business, what you're doing is you're making thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of small micro bets. And those bets are in the provision of liquidity to a client. What does that mean? It means that if you guys are trying to buy a stock, I'm going to give you the liquidity. I'm going to sell you that. And I'm going to capture that bid-ask spread. And that bid-ask spread is the gap between what I'm willing to pay for a stock or a token, what I'm willing to sell for it. So long as I get random orders on either side of that, I will capture that spread. I'm making a market. So it's a good business. If you make money at 51% of those trades on hundreds of thousands of trades, you're going to make money due to the laws of probability. Now, what happened here, my thesis, is that you had smarter, faster players enter the category, like Jump and Wintermute. In fact, you can look at data on chain, and it shows that Wintermute was making a lot of money trading against Alameda. It's a lot of data there. But FTX needs Alameda to make a market. Otherwise, it can't have an exchange. There's no liquidity. And that's how FTX makes its revenue, is charging these transaction fees. And Alameda, to your point, they need an exchange because that's where they have an edge. They have a competitive advantage because they can see this order flow. And it's alleged that they had special treatment. They had like a back door. They had a no margin call process. There's a no liquidation from FTX. The issue, however, is if you want to be a good market maker, if you want to be the house, you have to have low latency. That means having fast data pipes. And let me explain a little bit more what's going on there. So what a market maker is doing is they're scanning all the other exchanges. They're looking at Coinbase, they're looking at Binance, looking at all the major exchanges to identify where the market's quoting, what's bid, what's ask. Because if you misquote, let's say Coinbase quotes $12 for a token, they're bidding $12, and I bid too much, I bid higher than Coinbase, then someone like Wintermute is going to sell me at $12.50, and they can buy, have an offsetting transaction like Coinbase. So they made 50 cents, and I'm out 50 cents. So latency and speed matters. You need to have great data pipes. You need to have ultra-fast computers. You know, you have technology like co-located servers. You can't rely on Amazon Web Services, which they were spending money on.
FTX and Alameda were using AWS.
Yeah, Amazon was a creditor. Now, presuming they were using AWS for other kinds of things, but if you're using AWS to go do market making, you're going to lose. You're going to lose that battle.
And this idea of high frequency trading, I mean, this is the stuff that Michael Lewis talks about in Flash Boys,
yes.
Isn't it? These guys spending literally, I mean, it's hundreds of millions of dollars, isn't it, on technology that will buy them thousandths of a second in being able to execute these trades.
That's right. In the U.S. equity markets, it's very advanced and much more mature than in crypto. So just to be clear, crypto, you don't need like microwave technology yet, but it's a race to the bottom. Whoever's faster wins. So it's a speed game. And to get speed, you have to invest in infrastructure. So for example, one of the leaders in the US market would be Citadel, mm-hmm. or Knight Capital Group, or Two Sigma or Renaissance Technologies are storied institutions. They're very private, they're very profitable, and they invest billions of dollars, so much so that if you've got a fiber optic cable linking, say, New York City to the London Stock Exchange, that's too slow because the speed of light needs to bend and curve in the water, and that creates a disadvantage. It's that's how important speed is.
Wow.
So they'll invest in microwave technology, straight line path. The refraction of light creates a disadvantage. Again, that's not using crypto yet, but it'll get there for sure. It has to.
Yeah. And okay, so it seems like Alameda in particular, they were hopelessly out of their depth. I mean, you know, to go back to the idea of a casino, they've started to play sort of very high stakes poker, and much bigger, much wilier, and more experienced players have come in and sat down at the table with them and just started cleaning them out on every hand. Is that a fair analogy to use?
That's generally right. I'll say this, like, the house generally has an edge, right? Mm-hmm. Casinos make money. It's like 51%, whatever the probability is. So they're playing many, many poker hands on which they have a small edge. However, one day the game changes because better players show up and they have the edge because of the speed game. So now Alameda starts to use other types of techniques and takes on real risk. Real risk means they're making a bet on the market direction. HFT never actually makes a bet on the market direction. They're willing to buy and sell the same token. They're just making a bet on that spread, on the gap between the bid and the offer. That's it. They don't have a view on where these prices are going because they're entering and exiting positions so quickly that they're actually market neutral. So now Alameda starts investing in protocols and they start doing like these VC strategies, meaning getting access to the pre-mine, offering to make a market, and then mandating that where they invest, that their portcos or portfolio companies have to custody at FTX. So they start adjusting, and Caroline discusses it in the tweet thread. She acknowledges publicly that SBF changed their strategy.
So this is purely because Alameda are having to figure out new ways to make money. You know, they're losing at this market making game. They're being cleaned out by people with more experience and better, you know, better equipment. So they look to other ways, and this is when these directional bets on various shitcoins start coming into play.
That's the idea, exactly. They have to find a new way to make money. There's this article that was in Forbes that reports that prior to 2022, prior to Luna, prior to Three Arrows Capital, prior to Genesis, last year, 2021, bull market, that FTX and Alameda lost $3.7 billion. So they were losing money, and they had to find a way to make money. And again, FTX and Alameda need each other. Without Alameda, FTX is an exchange accounting for liquidity. Alameda without FTX has no edge, and that's their business. It's to go trade, make markets. So yes, I believe that's exactly the case. They started to shift their approach, shift strategies, taking on real risk. And they started losing money on those risks, on those bets as well. And they, of course, added leverage.
And then things start to just keep, you know, the slide just accelerates, I guess.
That's right. You know, here's an example. So apparently Alameda lost $1 billion via a levered bet on MobileCoin, right? So that's another loss. Consider that FTX only raised $2 billion in equity capital, by the way. So they raised $2 billion in equity capital. They lost $3.7 billion before this year. So the fraud must have happened before this year. They're losing more money than almost twice as much as the money they raised in capital. So they must have tapped customer funds well before this crypto bear market. But it gets worse because when the crypto bear market starts, what happens? Most people on the exchanges are selling. That's what a bear market is, and more sellers and buyers. So who's making the market? Alameda. Alameda's got to make a market. They got to take the other side of these trades. So people are selling. They're dumping on who? Alameda. So they're not in a good position, and their position's deteriorating. Of course, somewhere along the way, FTX tries to issue this FTT token. They do issue it. It creates some capital for them. And, you know, I think you've probably analyzed this guy about how they were borrowing against this illiquid token, FTT, right?
Yeah.
So that doesn't help anything. But, you know, my broader point was that I think initially 3 or 4 weeks ago, people focused on that. And so that was the downfall of FTX Alameda. I was like, no. That was actually a survival tactic by FTX after they were already in the hole. They're throwing stuff at a wall and seeing what sticks at that point.
And I mean, presumably, for, you know, this being the case, if this hole sort of opened up in 2021, you know, and money has just been pouring into it ever since. Like, so every move that FTX and Alameda have made in, you know, over the last year or so, over the last 18 months, however long it's been since, you know, since they really started to bleed, every move they've made has been presumably to try and plug this hole that gets ever bigger, no matter what they try.
That's right. They've tried to do two things. So one is plug the hole by pivoting, trying to make money here or there, taking on more risk, trying to raise money, which no one's doing, tapping into customer funds. Also, they took steps to protect from being discovered. They never had a CFO. How does that make any sense? They didn't have a board of directors that met that had controls. They never had a real Big Four auditor. So not only were they trying to survive illegally and by committing fraud and multiple layers of fraud, just to be clear, they also took steps to stop any type of scrutiny, checks and balances, controls, or even management. Their head of compliance was working previously at a fraud run poker betting. So my opinion is that this is a deliberate, willful fraud, and therefore it's bigger than Bernie Madoff, the destruction of capital and the losses. And the losses are spread out across at least 1 million investors globally, unlike Madoff, who was concentrated amongst fewer wealthy people, and they were able to recover the vast majority of the principal and make many of these investors whole. That will not happen in the case of FTX. That's why FTX is a bigger fraud than Bernie Madoff. And the pain that he caused to small investors globally and the loss of confidence in not just FTX, but crypto institutions, everything's being tested. The consequences of this are severe, and we're still going through kind of the unfolding and the contagion. Like, the long-term secular promise for crypto is there. However, you know, we were in a winter before FTX, and now we've got a winter within a winter.
And it's, I mean, even those people who didn't have any funds on FTX, who never interacted with it at all, you know, if you're in crypto, if you're in this industry in any way, shape or form, you are affected no matter what your exposure to FTX or Alameda. And I guess with Madoff, it was, as you say, a lot more concentrated, a lot more localized amongst, you know, a relatively smaller pool of investors.
And a wealthy pool of investors too.
Yeah. Different,
right? So.
Not just the, you know, the average people. And of course, the stories about people with really not very much to lose in the first place, losing everything, you know, that's still being stuck on the exchange.
Right.
It's terrible. It's heartbreaking.
Absolutely.
And I mean, Madoff didn't act alone, did he? I mean, you know, some people close to him seem to have known what was going on, but you know, it was obviously the buck eventually stopped with him. For a fraud this size, for what's been going on at FTX and Alameda for the past 18 months or so, I mean, SBF seems to be the big kind of lightning rod for criticism here. Partly, I guess, because he's out there, you know, sort of running his mouth with sort of verbal diarrhea at the moment, just, you know, just spewing forth these attempts to kind of you know, launder his reputation, I guess. And everyone else involved has kept so quiet. But I mean, other people at FTX and Alameda must have known about this. This can't just be SBF, surely.
That'd be my conclusion as well. And I'll come back to that in a second. But one thing I will say is regarding Sam's verbal diarrhea, he has a deliberate strategy here. His argument, in a nutshell, he is claiming he was negligent. He is claiming he was grossly negligent. Of course, that's a legal term that implies civil liability, meaning he's essentially saying, yeah, you should sue me. That's what he's saying. But he's saying he's not a criminal. He didn't commit fraud. That's why in his interviews, he's saying, oh, shucks, should have done X, should have done better. By the way, in that George Stephanopoulos video interview, he says, not that he didn't focus on risk, he didn't do it, full stop.
Yeah.
Just clearly gross negligence, right? But he's not owning fraud. So there is a method to his verbal diarrhea. He's trying to focus on that, right? Now, on your point, Guy, around others involved, look, Alameda allegedly had a backdoor that exempted them from liquidations versus other customers. So that was coded. Now, that coding took place either at the direction of Sam or someone coded it. Okay, pretty sure it came from Sam. But still, someone had to code it. Second, you had a director of compliance that had an obligation, had a duty. Even also, if you don't have a CFO, someone is looking at the P&L, the profit and loss or income statement. By the way, this is one thing that is complete BS that Sam keeps saying. He's saying, oh, well, we don't have the numbers. But here's the thing. The exchange and Alameda every day would have something called a trading P&L. It shows all the open positions and it shows how much money you made or lost that day. It's like thinking of the house casino. How much money do we make or lose this day? And they do analysis of that. Are we making money on this trade or losing this trade? Not just on the exchange where they're doing, but also on the margin. And they'll say, okay, how many loans do we have outstanding? What's our net interest income on those loans? Are those loans backed by the appropriate collateral? Do assets equals liabilities and equity? These are basic things. It's not like he's trying to make the argument that risk management was supposed to happen somewhere else and he didn't do it. But in the nature of an exchange and a trading business, it's the same thing. Like you need that dashboard that says, here's a trading P&L. And of course he had that. This is a guy that was doing tweet threads on Coinbase's P&L, by the way, very precisely analyzing transaction fees. And he's saying he doesn't have that. He doesn't have that reporting or infrastructure. He acknowledges he had dashboards, by the way. He doesn't have the central dashboard describing his own P&L. It makes no sense.
I guess, it's focused, isn't it? Negligence carries a lot lighter sentence than criminality, than outright fraud. So, I mean, I guess what we're seeing now is the start of SBF's defense, but. And I guess it's going to be so interesting to see what happens with these other people, the likes of Caroline, the likes of Sam Trabuco and people like that, and Gary Wang, who have all kept very, very quiet. But I guess, you know, the speculation isn't there that Caroline may have cut a plea bargain if this photo of her in New York, not far from the district attorney's office, is to be believed. Do you see that as a kind of likely outcome to this realm, that, you know, the others at FTX and Alameda will seek to pin this on Sam as much as possible?
I'm not a criminal defense attorney, but your reasoning is it sounds right. Sure, these are young people in their careers. They trusted Sam. There's some kind of hero worship going on here. Some of them may have been naive. And I think it's in their best interest to cooperate with prosecutors.
And can I just pick up on that point you make, Ram, about these, you know, these guys are young, they're naive. So many people have commented on this, haven't they? It's like, how on earth were these guys, you know, not that long out of college, not that long out of university, how on earth were they able to run this thing? And when I was looking, you know, when I was thinking about this, obviously, and this is related to what you talked about in the tweet thread, but to go back just very briefly to the sort of early days of Alameda Research. So I think most people now are aware that Alameda, Sam and Alameda kind of started off basically doing arbitrage trades, trading the kimchi premium. And, you know, that is how Alameda kind of made its name and, you know, got its kind of startup capital, I guess. I think the story is that they supposedly started with $200 and, you know, grew that by making these arbitrage trades into millions. So I guess, does that explain in a way that, you know, these guys, the reason that they were able to get to this position is because they started off doing something kind of relatively simple. I mean, arbitraging is not a particularly sophisticated trading strategy, as I understand it, and especially in a market like crypto, which is still relatively unsophisticated. And back then, you know, I think we're talking kind of 2017, 2018, you know, the fact that you've got this massive difference in the price of, or this appreciable difference in the price of Bitcoin on an exchange in the US, and then you know, a different price in South Korea and Japan. I guess these guys kind of started off playing, you know, playing a very simple game, if you like, and as you say, that kind of developed over time. You know, arbitraging becomes, I guess, is it a case that the big players just got in on it and were better at arbitraging than them? Or do you think it's more a case that the market itself just got a bit more sophisticated and these arbitrage bets became kind of harder to make?
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com, one place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
So first off, arbitrage is rare and fleeting, and it generally doesn't exist in markets. That's one. So that Kimchi trade you described is very close to arbitrage. Arbitrage, of course, is a riskless trade. You buy something in market X, you sell it in market Y simultaneously, so you don't have any exposure. The Kimchi trade is close to that, but there's some like time delays between various actions. You know, of course, that trade, you know, went away, and then they got into market making, which is, you know, a high frequency trading kind of business, as we described. That's not arbitrage, though. You are taking risk. HFTs can lose money too. Now, when an HFT loses money, they stop. This is the thing you didn't do. You stop doing that business. You can see it every day. You can see you have an edge, like the house. The house makes money 55% of the time, then 54% of the time, then 53. And you can see, oh, you know what? We're making less money every day. That would have been their experience. Then you get to 51, then 50, then 50. Now you're just treading water. Then 49 and a half, then 49. That's the point when you exit. So as I mentioned, my prior life, I used to have these statistical arbitrage strategies. So one day we saw that, okay, we're like, okay, two sigma is investing more. We're pretty sure who's on the other side of this. Maybe it's time for us to move on. So we exit the business. That's what you're supposed to do. So to your point, I think what happened here is they had faster, more nimble, better equipped players like Wintermute, like Jump, like Jane, their alma mater that stepped in. And again, you can see this in the on-chain data. So where did the $2 billion in equity go? Here's part of what happened is it went to their customers, which is ironic enough, certain customers, the most sophisticated customers, because it's called the VIG. You know, where do you go for the VIG? And if you talk to traders internationally, sophisticated ones, even smaller ones, by the way, you don't have to be that large. I mean, the VIG was attractive at FTX. The same strategy wouldn't work on Coinbase, but it would work on FTX Global because the quoting machine, that bid-ask machine, was broken. It was spitting out stale prices, not the best prices. So I think it was with the entrance of new players that caused them to lose their edge and caused them, you know, to lose money.
Okay. And okay, so let's kind of fast forward a bit then. Let's go, because again, like, I think a lot of the prevailing narrative up to now has been that, you know, prior to kind of May this year, it feels such a long time ago, even though it was only this year, it feels like years ago, given everything that's happened since. But obviously the prevailing narrative before this was that everything was kind of okay, and then Terra happened. And, you know, this the market kind of goes into, well, the UST and Luna go into this death spiral, and everyone starts hemorrhaging cash. Everyone is taking huge losses. And then we see this contagion spread. We see Three Arrows Capital go down, and then we see the likes of, you know, these centralized lending and borrowing platforms, the likes of Celsius and Voyager and BlockFi and all this go down. And then we have this extraordinary situation whereby FTX and Alameda are kind of the white knights coming to the rescue and being like, okay, well, you know, we'll take you out of, you know, we'll give you an injection of liquidity, we'll, you know, stave off bankruptcy. So what exactly was going on there?
Two great rich topics to go down, actually. So first off, one is, what is the cause of the decline and the systematic risk in crypto? I argue in a different tweet thread, that's actually not Luna. It starts with the grayscale discount widening and the end of the GBTC carry trade. We'll come back to that in a moment if you'd like, Guy.
Yeah,
so it's an interesting thread to go down. So then, you know, the second around contagion, of course, you know, you had players like Genesis that had impaired loans to Three Arrows Capital, which has caused a credit seizing and a testing of various parties.
Well, let's look at, you know, this idea of, you know, the 3AC and the kind of Celsius route, because I think that was, again, something that has affected kind of, you know, your average crypto holder perhaps more than what's been going on, you know, with Genesis and Grayscale. Because obviously Grayscale in particular is an institutional vehicle, isn't it?
Fair point. So they're connected in this way. So let's let's frame it up. So you have these non-banks pretending to be banks. Who do I mean there? Celsius, Voyager, BlockFi. And they've all failed 3 for 3. Now, there's one question is, did they fail because of bad management, bad risk management? And that's a narrative out there. That's the conventional wisdom. I'm saying, no. They failed because of their business model. If you're a non-bank pretending to be a bank, that ends in tears. Why? Let me lay this out here. What these actors were doing is they were taking in depositor funding, kind of advertising as a bank or using these EARN programs. Then they were lending. And that's what banks do. You take in short-term deposits, and those deposits are liquid, meaning you can take your deposits out tomorrow or in a short period of time. But then they're lending on assets. What are those assets? Well, those are loans to hedge funds. So they're risky, first of all. They're making loans to hedge funds. And those loans are illiquid. There's no market for them. It's not like lending on a house like a mortgage. A mortgage has actually a liquid market for mortgages. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac buy them, right? Mm. So what happens here? They're borrowing from short-term depositors, paying out a lower interest, 1%, 2%, in heyday used to be obviously more. They lend out to these hedge funds that are paying out 5, 7, 8, 10, 12%, 15%. And they're trying to capture that spread. Like we call that an interest margin in the bank. The thing is, the bank is protected from a bank run because of two things. One, they have deposit insurance in the form of the FDIC.
Yeah.
The FDIC says, I'll protect your deposits up to $250,000. So people are secure in depositing at their bank. As much as we hate the banks, they still like depositing at the bank, right? That's one. The second thing is they got a lender of last resort, which is the Federal Reserve. So if you get in a bank run, what the bank can do is they can take their assets, which are illiquid, and they can pledge those assets, certain eligible assets, I should say, to be clear. They can pledge those assets to the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve will get the liquidity, cash, to meet the demands of depositors. Now, recall back in 2008, we saw this thing happen there too. Remember General Electric, GE Capital. I'm going to nerd out a little bit here. GE Capital was borrowing in these short-term commercial paper markets. Commercial paper is seven-day loan, right, on average, seven-day loan. It's just a corporate borrowing market. So borrowing there, and they're making these longer term loans. But what happens is if those investors in that commercial paper, those depositors, if they don't keep stepping up every 7 days and rolling over that investment, then they can't fund these loans, which have a longer duration of 1, 3, 5, 7, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And they can't sell those loans that they're making because it's not liquidity. And if they have to sell the loan, and somehow they can magically sell the loan, they're selling that loan at a much lower price than the face value of the loan. And that creates what's called an impairment. That impairment eats into the equity dollar for dollar, and it creates the risk of insolvency. So that's what happened with Celsius, BlockFi, and Voyager. It's not a management thing, although there were management deficiencies, absolutely, and lousy risk management, yes. Overriding, you know, this Forbes article that came out on this yesterday. However, it's broader than that. It's a business model issue. Only banks, by the way, in the United States are permitted to what's called rehypothecate. Rehypothecate is the technical term for taking your customer funds and then lend them out to another party. Can't do that unless you're a bank in the United States. This is why BlockFi got $100 million fine from the SEC.
Yeah.
They said, hey, BlockFi, you're not a bank. You've got this product that pays out yield. So if you're not a bank, only banks can pay out deposit interest rate. So if you're not a bank, then that must be security. That's how they analyze it. But that security is not registered with the SEC. And therefore, here's a $100 million fine and cease and desist that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, I mean, these, you know, Celsius in particular is the one that comes to mind. But I mean, these guys, you know, they explicitly advertise themselves as not being banks. You know, unbank yourself. That was the Celsius one. You know, that's what Alex Mazinski right. would have on his T-shirt. But all the while sort of not being, you know, saying that they're not banks – but trying to actually act like banks, even though they're not allowed to do that.
They are breaking the law. I'm disappointed that Alex Mashinsky, in my opinion, hasn't been indicted. And that's unfortunate. And by the way, I was the last person to be on a panel with Alex in late May. And I called out some of these issues and threatened to throw me off stage, by the way. There's a write-up around this. So,
wow.
And that was uncomfortable. This is before these players blew up. So here's a guy with a million people on Twitter. And it was not pleasant.
No. Yeah,
but you're right. Look, they're my opinion. I say my opinion because I don't want a defamation case, is that they were breaking the law.
And do you think, I mean, you know, whether they were breaking the law or not, as you say, this is, you know, primarily a failure of a business model. You know, Celsius, Voyager and BlockFi, by the sound of it, were never really going to work, even if they were being run properly behind the scenes. This is a gravy train that could only run for so long.
That's right. Ultimately, you'll have a crisis of confidence, and people will want to know, are my funds secure? Is my savings secure? When savings, people don't expect principal loss. So they want safety. And what happens is when there's a crisis of confidence, people want to test that. And they say, you know, I'm going to take my funds back. And then they start experiencing issues. So they've got, if you're Celsius, you've got to sell an asset to create liquidity. But again, those assets aren't in the liquid market. And to create liquidity, you've got to sell them at a discount, which forces a loss upon them. But you're right. It's fundamentally a business model issue, which is another wonderful irony of crypto, which is that crypto, you know, trust still matters in a trustless world. Crypto is premised on trustlessness. I'm sympathetic to that. I wrote a Wall Street Journal op-ed in October with former SEC chair Arthur Levitt espousing the ability of crypto to, for the first time, enable transactions without intermediaries like banks or exchanges. That's phenomenal technology. It's never existed before in human history. It's like a civilization upgrade that we can transact without a trusted party in the middle. However, the full crypto stack isn't decentralized yet. So you have trust requirements at different points, namely the on-ramp key point. However you get your money into crypto, you got to wire ACH funds to some party that you need to trust. It could be a trust bank, it could be an exchange like Coinbase, or in this case, it could be an FTX or a Celsius. And there are other elements that are not decentralized. So we're not yet ready for a full Web3 world. We're not there yet. So what do you need? You need a Web 2.5 world. You need a world where you have trusted institutions that are well capitalized, that have liquidity, that have public reporting, and yes, put the assets and the liabilities on chain in real time with third-party audits and controls. That's the world we need to move toward on the journey towards a greater, you know, world of decentralization and economic sovereignty and human freedom.
Because it seems that, you know, it seems that we've kind of fallen victim, I guess, to, well, opportunism on the one hand. You know, we've had these, you know, we've had these services like Celsius, Voyager and BlockFi, you know, and also like FTX and Alameda come in and exploit the fact that crypto is a young market, that crypto doesn't have these sort of, you know, these protections that banks have. And kind of take advantage of that. Offer people high yield. You know, offer people, you know, what they can't get anywhere else. So there's the opportunism from these players on the one hand, and obviously when the tide goes out, they get, you know, we see just how opportunistic they were being. But of course, on the other hand, that opportunism can't flourish if there are regulations, if there are procedures, safeguards in place, sure, like the banking industry it has. And as you say, Ram, I mean, we're us in crypto, we're very, you know, we look down on banks, we're very rude about them and stuff. But I mean, the banking industry, yeah, I guess, has, you know, you have this to say for it, it has many decades, many centuries behind it of innovation and these things and, you know, experience, I guess. And these protections are kind of a hard one because I guess, you know, the banking sector went through these sorts of convulsions many years ago and came out the better for it.
Yes. You're absolutely right. You know, two things. First off, DeFi has worked. I want to be clear on that. And I see the promise and potential of DeFi. It's a shame that these institutional lenders weren't using DeFi to manage their risk. I was sitting in the vault. Now, the reasons why it didn't happen, we don't spend too much time around that, because DeFi International wasn't ready for institutions. It's ready for retail through these dApps, right?
Yeah.
You need API. You need a lot of other things to make it institutional ready, and someone needs to go build that. That would be a really exciting project. But to your point, yeah, like in the 19th century, bank blowups and failures happen every recession. Every 8 to 10 years, you see scores of banks go bankrupt. And in the Great Depression, you know, it's now been, you know, really the last 10, 15, 20 years, people have discovered Bernanke won a Nobel Prize for really correcting the history. It wasn't the collapse of 1929 stock market that started the Depression. It wasn't the erection trade barrier. That's not it. This is what we learned in school growing up, right? What it was is a bank failure. The Federal Reserve let a major bank fail. And that caused a crisis of confidence, and people lost confidence in the banking system. People withdrew their funds. And the same situation. Banks have these long-term illiquid assets. They cannot deliver the cash that the depositors thought was safe, and the rest is history. But we've learned from that as a species. Don't let the banks fail. Don't let the banks fail. Make sure it's a line of last resort. Have deposit insurance. And yes, have oversight and control. It's not easy being a bank. You can't start a bank tomorrow. It's multiple years. You have to have capital, you have to have oversight. You have visits from the FDIC and the Federal Reserve. They can look at your books whenever you want. They can examine, they'll camp out in your offices. Meanwhile, these exchanges are very lightly regulated. They're regulated as like money services business or money transmission business, which is the same standard of regulation as like a check cashier on the corner in the low-income neighborhood, by the way. Or like if you go to the airport, you know, like when you exchange money?
Yeah.
That's a money services business. Exchanges, even in the U.S., are regulated at that level, by the way. At that level. Okay. So, however, some adopt a higher level of regulation. Like Anchorage is regulated like a trust bank, or Paxos is regulated like a trust bank. And that means they have to, they're subject to and they're embracing a much higher standard of control, supervision, regulation, capital, etc. The penalties of breaking the laws of bank are very severe. Not just management expulsion, they can take away your charter. They can take away your right to do banking, civil penalties. And if you break sanctions law, criminal penalties. But on the flip side, that creates trust. That's why, you know, we still use banks as much as we hate them.
Yeah, there is that trust there, isn't it? And I mean, I guess, yeah, as you point out, the bitter irony of all this is that crypto is, you know, was invented with this idea of trustlessness in mind, and yet we've allowed these opportunists to flood in and you know, let ourselves trust them because, you know, because in a way they make it easy. You talk about the difficulties of getting money into crypto and storing it and all this sort of stuff. And I guess these guys kind of fit the bill in that sort of respect, didn't they? And they made it made them very easy to use. Whereas at DeFi, you know, DeFi is complicated. DeFi is still hard. The average person doesn't want to touch that. Yet, you know, you had these CeFi players go, hey, you know, this is easy. This looks just like your bank's website. Nothing to worry about here.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Yeah, no, exactly right. Look, I think DeFi has extraordinary potential. I'm really excited about what we can do with DeFi. I think it can strengthen the banks, it can strengthen capital markets. You can avoid a 2008 crisis, but we're not ready yet. We need to invest more. And you're right. People value convenience over security. Happens all the time. Why do we like the microwave? It's not because it makes great chicken. It's because it's fast and easy to use, right? Same reason why people don't want to memorize a seed phrase or have to interact with a hardware wallet. The normie population, which is the bulk of the world, if you want to 10x crypto, if you want to bring crypto to the next level, it's not going to be through teaching everyone how to use a hardware. My grandma's not going to use a hardware wallet.
Very true.
It's going to be through channels that they understand and relate to, that are easy to access and highly usable, where they get service, and it goes back to trust. It'll be familiar. The same way, no one talks about TCP/IP. It's all in the background, but it's used in every internet data transaction. In the same way, when crypto achieves its success in the long run, it'll be something in the background, as stocks will be tokens on chain, let's say. Money will be on chain. Money is already on chain. They call it a stable coin. There's more to do around that.
And there's so much building still to be done, isn't there? There's so much, this stuff, it kind of talking, in a similar way, Rams, similar to what you do, what you guys do and what you've done through a lot of your career is, as you say, kind of providing these, these gears behind the scenes, kind of greasing the wheels behind the scenes. People don't really know what happens, but they don't care. They just want it to be, a seamless experience. They want to know that they're not going to, that their deposits are covered. Then they want to know that it's not going to all disappear tomorrow. And I guess until crypto can offer those sorts of guarantees, it's going to be a hard sell for the average person.
There are challenges ahead. I agree. I think you said it well. Like, you need investment in infrastructure. You also need better policy and more education out there. And it's always the same lessons. Every cycle comes back to the same components. But I'd also say, crypto DeFi right now doesn't offer much yield for reasons we know. So it's hard to currently grow the ecosystem, and given exactly what you said, getting it. But there are other ways. Like, dislocations do create opportunities, right? So, and this is not financial advice. we have to do our own analysis on this, right? Guys smirking, because whenever someone says not financial advice, they're about to give financial advice. No, this is truly not financial advice, but just, dislocations can happen. Rising rates happen when volatility goes up. For instance, there's a Coinbase bond. I haven't looked at this in a few weeks. I want to do an analysis on it. But it's trading like 60 cents on the dollar. And now it's got a 12% coupon or interest rate. So you buy that bond, and that bond is short duration, meaning it'll pay back its principal in the next couple of years. And that bond will go from 60 cents to a dollar provided that Coinbase delivers its scheduled principal and interest payments. And they've got $5 billion in cash on the balance sheet. And it's paying off 12% interest, which is better than what you get on these other platforms. Yeah. And that's legal, it's compliant. So, you know, there are opportunities out there. I'd say, again, talk to an advisor that knows what they're doing. You know, we work with crypto whales. That's our area of expertise. So happy to have a conversation around that. You can shoot us an email. I'm happy to. But there are other opportunities like that in the market that are emerging because of these dislocations.
And it's interesting that you cite Coinbase there, Ram, because obviously Coinbase, US-based exchange, it has had to jump through so many regulatory hoops. I mean, I take your point about the fact that it's, you know, it's still not as not nearly as regulated as a bank is or anything like that. But, you know, as crypto exchanges go, the likes of Coinbase and Kraken and Gemini, you know, these US, these exchanges that are, you know, based in the mainland United States, they have gone through a lot more of the regulatory procedures than a lot of others have, and have been kind of criticized for it in the past. You know, they've had to charge higher fees and things like that, and, you know, maybe haven't been able to offer the same the same kind of services or the same kind of altcoins or things like that other exchanges, you know, that haven't been as compliant, you know, they've been able to be more nimble. But this really shows that perhaps, you know, the proper channels to do it properly may well be paying off.
I think it's a good conclusion. Yeah, look, trust still matters in the trustless world. You need players that are compliant and playing the long game, that are leading with trust and integrity. I would never have. It's so surprising to say that a differentiator in crypto is that this player conducts themselves with integrity. In any other industry, that's the assumption that they conduct themselves with integrity, right? You really can't make this up. And here in crypto, we're saying, well, Coinbase leads with integrity. But yeah, players that embrace regulations is where you want to focus. Specifically, look for trust banks, because trust banks have the highest standard. The only standard, well, there are a few standards higher than that. These are subtle points, but one would be like a full service bank. A trust bank doesn't necessarily have FDIC, but trust banks have significant controls and capital and third parties and audit firms to protect against fraud, and multiple parties at the bank with different roles and responsibilities to protect against fraud by law. Mm.
And okay, Ram, I'm conscious that I've taken up a lot of your time on this Friday, but I want to end with a question for you, sort of. So we've seen this year, I mean, 2022 has been just, you know, the year of the beast in crypto terms. And we keep seeing this, don't we? We saw it with Mt. Gox, and then, you know, we had Terra earlier this year, and now we've had FTX. You know, we've had these convulsions in the industry that we've had to go through. And kind of each time the industry's kind of picked itself up, dusted itself off and kept going. Do you think this is a watershed moment, or do you think, you know, down the line we're going to have to go through more of these convulsions? We're going to have to keep learning these lessons the hard way.
That's a great question, Guy. Look, human nature forgets after a few years. So this will happen again. It happens every cycle. I mentioned GE Capital in 2008, but people in crypto don't know what the heck GE Capital was. And yeah. And this happened 10 years before that, and it'll happen again and again and again. So, however, the infrastructure improves and the service providers improve and customers start to learn. So there is progress. There is improvement. You know, it'll get better. So you just got to keep your wits about you, do your homework, Wealth creation doesn't happen through an overnight get rich quick scheme betting on a meme coin. Any winner there has a matching loser somewhere else. Okay. Play the long game, preserve your wealth. You know, what Albert Einstein said, that the eighth miracle of the world is compounded returns, right? And you have an environment where there are dislocations, so there are opportunities. I think you can do well. And maybe early stage crypto VC firms that have real skill know what they're doing. We allocate to what we think are the best firms globally that do this. So I think that's all I have to say on that front.
And I guess it's up to the crypto user, whether they're, you know, whether they're a retail investor, whether they're a retail trader, whether they're institution, whatever, to, I guess, kind of vote with their feet in many ways. It's like we, you know, identify who the good players are, ask the hard questions about, you know, things like reserves and liabilities. You know, there's so much talk, isn't there, at the moment, of exchanges publishing proof of reserves, proof of liabilities and things like this. It's like we as crypto users have to demand it and say, okay.
It's hard. Sorry, I just want to chime in there. Here's why I'm kind of mixed on. So for my main message is focus on the most regulated player. Here's why. I was on a panel with Alex Mashinsky and I asked him, why don't you put your assets and liabilities on chain? He said he did, and it's nonsense. He did not, much less liabilities. So people will say all sorts of nonsense. Say, oh, it's on chain. Well, who's validating the contents of the chain?
Yeah.
What's the node validation mechanism for the balance sheet? In other words, the technical expertise to assess the comments of these people is very high. Like, I spent 20 years doing this stuff, so I know where to focus. And even then, like, you don't get all the data you want. It's very difficult, even for someone like me. So my main message is focus on the most regulated players. Focus on trust banks. There's actually, it's a specific regulatory term, trust bank, at least in the United States, if you're in the US. You know, avoid, ask, what's the jurisdiction of this player? Who is their primary regulator? And seek the highest form of regulation if you're going through that kind of channel. And yeah, we should still ask for assets and liabilities. Actually, yes, we should. But how can you trust these players when they're saying they're doing these things and they're blowing up 2 or 3 months later? I don't trust what they say.
Very true.
There's a lot to do. Back to my infrastructure. A few years from now, we could have the infrastructure. We can verify these things on chain. But we're not going to have it overnight. Even the next year, it won't be there. Even if you see the data on the equivalent of like Etherscan, let's say, the oracles could have faulty inputs that feed Etherscan.
Yeah. I mean, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes, do we? In the immediate kind of fallout of FTX, when everyone was kind of scrambling to offer proof of reserves, you know, there were suspiciously large amounts of crypto kind of moving between various exchanges for reasons that were never sort of satisfactorily explained. So, yeah, you're right, Ram. We can't rely on these. Certainly, the technology doesn't exist for us to be, for these things to be proved beyond doubt. We have to take the steps ourselves.
That's right. Exactly.
Well, Ram, thank you so much for today. I've taken up so much of your time, and I really appreciate you you shedding some light on all this for us. We covered FTX and Alameda, and then kind of wandered across to this sort of the broader kind of spectrum of crypto, and how we kind of navigate that landscape. But there is still so much to unpack about FTX and Alameda that's obviously going to come out in the next few weeks. And obviously, I guess we're probably going to be looking ahead to Tuesday. Is SBF going to pitch up and testify before Congress, perhaps perjure himself before Congress, or is he going to risk a subpoena instead? There's so much still to happen.
Right. We'll see what happens. I'm sure gonna have a lot of phrases involving the expression "to my knowledge" and as far as I can recollect. But first off, guys, thank you. It's been a pleasure, and I appreciate your leadership in the category. You're a Sherpa for many investors, and appreciate your leadership and the thoughtful questions. Happy to pay it forward and do the best I can contribute here. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Ram. Yeah, well, we must do this again sometime. Perhaps when there are, you know, yet more of these gory details emerge, we can get together again and unpack some of them.
Okay. You bet, absolutely. And until then, you know, you can find me on at Ram Ahluwalia. I know it's a mouthful, at Ram Ahluwalia, or at Lumida Wealth. We publish real-time research and takes there. We're going to have a nice thread on Silvergate in a few days, and another thread on DCG Genesis. I thought we beat that to death. Apparently, we have not. So there's more to come on that one. Crypto always keeps us busy, that is for sure.
Wow. Yeah, I was going to say, actually, folks, you must follow Ram on Twitter. I will leave links in the description to Ram and Lumida as well. Sure. But yeah, Ram, you've done a fantastic job of breaking down some of these things. And I really appreciate it. And I know lots of other people in the community appreciate it as well. So please keep up that good work. And let's chat again in the future.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you so much. Have a good one. Take care. Be well.
All Bye. The best. Thanks so much, Ram.
Appreciate it. No, great questions. Great questions. And I thought you took them in good directions, and you gave me a good, you teed up the softball so I could, you know, drop in the content there. So I thought it was well done. So good stuff, man.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it's a funny thing, this kind of thing of interviewing people, you know, talking to people and interviewing them. It's something that I've sort of only kind of just started doing, and you realize just how difficult it is. But right back at you. I appreciate you sort of, you know, taking any bones that I threw and running with them. It's
You're in Dubai, is that right?
Yes. We moved out here in September.
Cool. What's the best conference in Dubai for crypto to attend, do you think?
Wow, there are so many. The only sort of one that I've been to was Future Blockchain, this part of this huge JITEX summit, okay. And that was back in October. That was good. It was part of this larger, huge technology conference. So the kind of crypto bit was quite separate. I'm looking to go to some, you know, looking to go to some more, especially in the new year. I think they tend to be a little dry, I'm told. You know, they're not quite as good fun as things like Bitcoin Miami or things like that. We're actually trying to do some crypto events here, you know, under the Coin Bureau brand, because
really cool.
We're planning a sort of B2B event in March, I think, and then a big sort of B2C thing in London. We did it earlier this year in May, so I think we're going to do another one of those in the summer. So
right.
Ram, if you fancy a trip over to Dubai or to London, it would be great to have you at one of these events.
I'll give you a holler. Yeah, no, certainly let me know. I'll give you a holler. I have a trip out there. I have some dear crypto friends in Dubai as well. And if you're in New York, give me a holler too. We have these private dinners, like 10 to 20 people, but they're all operators or VCs in the New York market. So if you get to New York, give me like a 2-week notice. I can organize a dinner and get together. It's informal. You know, we pick up the tabs. Just bringing really great people together. And it's awesome. You know, these are people like from Genesis, from like crypto VCs. Point 72 is there. Apollo is there. I mean, it's a best idea format. So we have everyone go around the room and say one best idea, crypto or non-crypto, to invest in. And it's like a little icebreaker, and people have a drink and just hang out. So it's private conversation. So we do that about once a month or so. But yeah, if you're in our neck of the woods, give me a holler, or I'll be at Bitcoin Miami too. I'm happy to get a beverage. It'd be great to, you know, meet in person at some point. So
absolutely,
good stuff, man.
Absolutely. Oh well, this has been great. Thank you, Ram. And yeah, like I said in the in the interview itself, I'd love to do this again sometime if you'd be up for it.
Absolutely. And keep up the great work. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Have a good one, man. Take care, bud.
Cheers.
Bye. Have a good one.
Thank you so much for listening to the Coin Bureau podcast. If you'd like to learn more about cryptocurrency, you can visit our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Coin Bureau. You can also go to coinbureau.com for loads more information about all things crypto. You can follow me on Twitter at Coin Bureau, all one word. And I'm also active on TikTok and Instagram too.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.